Thanks, Ravi. Right, so this the title that was on the slide 5 minutes ago said Interacting Frobenius Algebras or HOF, which is the name of this paper, which is what I'm mostly going to be talking about. It's joint work with Kevin Dunn, who's my student back in Scotland. This picture is not very good, but I just want to point out to you the book that he is reading here. So you'll notice that it says mathematician and not physicist, so this is going to be quite mathematical. Apologies in advance. Okay, so what's the general program here is part of a big body of work called categorical quantum theory. And the idea is to take the quantum theory that we already know about and re-express all of this Hilbert space stuff, self-adjoint operators, et cetera, into a more abstract language, namely language of category theory. And in particular, where here we have Hilbert spaces, in the categorical quantum theory we'll have monoidal categories, and instead of all these operator algebras, we'll have particular kinds of internal algebras and co-algebras in these categories. Okay, so don't worry if all these words are unfamiliar, I will explain them all as we go. So this is the idea of categorical quantum mechanics, is to talk about quantum physics in the language of monoidal categories. But once you've written down this system here, it's basically an axiomatic definition. It makes it possible to talk about the algebras of this axiomatic theory, or the models of this axiomatic theory. And so to start to study the universal algebra, which is underneath the usual version of quantum mechanics. Okay, and so in order to talk about this idea of an algebraic theory, we use a particular kind of category called a prop. And I'll be particularly interested in the distributive laws of props. Okay, so what else are we going to say? Right, yes, the plan. So essentially what we're going to do is a kind of a free construction of something, some theory based on a pair of complementary observables. And that's the free construction is not going to give us very much to work with. So we'll progressively impose equations on this theory, and so create a sequence of props, each of which is a bit more like quantum theory. And at the end, this one will be quite like quantum theory, but not quite like it. Okay, so before we get into any kind of abstract nonsense, I just want to make perfectly clear the concrete things that I'm talking about, right? So I'm going to say the word observable a lot, and by that I mean a non-degenerate projective observable on a finite dimensional space. Okay, and so a non-degenerate projective observable in finite-dimensional space is just an orthonormal basis for that space. Okay, so an observable for me is an orthonormal basis. Okay, so given some basis, I say a state is unbiased if for every basis element, the inner product is equal in magnitude. Right? So I think everyone has seen this before. Okay. And every time I have an unbiased state, I can get a unitary map out of it by just basically writing its projections on the diagonal of a matrix. So far, so good? Okay, so given a basis A, this kind of unitary I'll call a phase map. And if you think about observables that you're familiar with, this is just basically going to be adding a complex factor to one term in the sum when any quantum state is expressed in that basis. Okay? Okay, so since I already mentioned these matrices are diagonal, so in particular they all commute. So the phases of any observable are an abelian group. Okay. Okay, next bit of structure that we care about is the idea of complementarity. And so we say that two observables are complementary if they are pairwise related like this. So this is basically saying that every element of one basis is unbiased with respect to the other basis. Okay. So this is familiar to everyone, I guess. Strongly complementary is something that we have made up for the purposes of this talk, or for the purpose of this body of work. It basically says that if I take the basis elements and I get their phase maps with respect to the other basis, those form a subgroup of the original phase group. Right, so I have this group here, which is defined one element for every unbiased state. So if I just take the states, which are the complementary basis, so it's strongly complementary if they're a subgroup of the phase group. Okay. So this is all very familiar, I guess. So we can start to make things a bit more abstract by talking about Frobenius algebras. So there's a nice theorem due to Jamie Vickery and Bob Cook and Dusko Pavlovich, which says that observables, in the sense I mentioned, i.e. orthonormal bases, are in a bijection with Dagger special commutative Frobenius algebras. So I will explain what this is later, but for now it suffices to note that Frobenius algebra is four operations on some base space. So I have this co-multiplication, so I take my underlying space to two copies of itself, a co-unit, which maps the space onto the base field, a multiplication, which takes two copies to one, and a unit, which produces an element from the base field. Okay. And in the world of finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, all of these special Dagger commutative Frobenius algebras are produced like this. You start with a basis, and you send the basis elements onto two copies of themselves. Okay. The co-unit is just the one, the map which sends each basis element onto the scalar one, and the multiply and the unit are just the usual linear adjoints of the other two. Okay. So the point of this theorem is saying that whenever I want to talk about an observable, I can forget about Hilbert spaces and talk about one of these things instead. And Frobenius algebras have an equational presentation, so you can talk about them in any monoidal category at all, not just in Hilbert spaces. Okay, and the key theorem, which everything else hangs, is the following. It says that two observables, i.e. two Frobenius algebras, are strongly complementary if and only if they form a Hopf algebra. So Hopf algebra, so let's go piece by piece. Frobenius algebra is these four things, or those four things, two different observables, two different algebras. And what I'm saying is, if they're complementary, I can re-bracket them like this, and the co-monoid and the monoid of one, and the co-monoid and the monoid of the other, form a Hopf algebra. Okay, so this is, again, a fairly simple equational theory. I'll show you the definition later. Okay, so strongly complementary means that I can do this. Oops. That. And if you're having trouble imagining what these things might be, there's a standard example, which is the group algebras of the cyclic groups. So if I take myself a d-dimensional Hilbert space and I label the basis elements with integers, then my co-multiplication, as we already said, is going to carry each basis element onto two copies of itself. And more interestingly, the multiplication here is taking n and m as a basis of the tensor product and sending it to n plus m, where this is the plus of Zd. Yeah? Okay. And the corresponding, so this is one Frobenius algebra here, this is the other one here, that pair is a Hopf algebra, and that pair is a Hopf algebra. Okay. And the theorem says that for complex finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, strongly complementary pairs are just group algebras of abelian groups. So that is, for Hilbert spaces, all of them. All right, so far, we have been very, very concrete. And as you may know, I like to do things rather more abstractly. So what one might do if one was categorically minded is to take something concrete and kind of abstractify it a bit and try to study its components. But maybe this is still a bit too complicated to think about, so we could think about degenerating it further and further into the basic atoms of the theory and study the individual pieces separately, see what we can learn. And so some guys did this already for the theory I've just been telling you about. So Bonci, Sobachinsky, Zanazzi. And they wrote this paper, which you'll notice has a similar title to the one that I raised for you, before many of you came in. And these here, let me get this right, these four here are the axioms of a bi-algebra, which is almost the same thing as a Hopf algebra. And these things here are the axioms of a Frobenius algebra. And they studied this theory in its kind of basic form. And so they started putting all the pieces back together again, and they didn't get what I wanted to see at the end, right? So their theory is about Petri nets. And so when I saw their paper, which is a very beautiful piece of work, I basically shat myself because I've been studying this system for years, thinking I was talking about quantum mechanics, and now they're telling me it was Petri nets, which is a model of concurrent computation, which is not very quantum at all. So I basically set out to try and understand why their theory was not quantum mechanics and why I did not have to resign in shame. So this is what I want to tell you about now. Okay, so as you have seen, we're going to do this in the style of 6 days of creation. There's only five, sorry. So in the beginning, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, definition one, a dagger category. No, we'll not do this yet. We'll do this first. So category theory for people who have who are not familiar with it. We don't need very much. So we're going to do everything in the form of pictures or diagrams. And basic elements will be boxes, which correspond to some interaction or process, and wires, which correspond to systems which are taking part in that interaction. Okay, so the wires might have names. The box will have a name, and the outputs will have names. And notice that I can have many wires going to the same box, I don't need to have the same number of inputs and outputs, etc., etc. And the way you would read this, if you want to think about it in terms of linear algebra, is that this is some matrix mapping the tensor product of two spaces onto the tensor product of three spaces. Okay. Right, so for me, time goes down. Okay. That won't actually be very important in this talk, but just to make it obvious. So what is a category, then? Category consists of two kinds of things, objects and arrows, which you can think of as boxes and wires. Right? So my arrows or my morphisms would be the boxes, and I have some kind of system coming in, some kind of system coming out. And I can do a couple of obvious things with these. I can plug the wires together if the names match. This is called composition. And I can put things in parallel under no restriction at all. And that's the tensor product. Notice that I form the tensor product of the wires just by putting wires next to each other. Okay. What else do I want to say about this? Right. And there is an enormous number of equations one can now write down to specify when this all makes sense. But the simple way of saying it is for me to say these pictures are unambiguous. Right? So what does that mean? It means that this composition sequentially is associative, the tensor product is associative, and I have the interchange law between the sequential and the parallel compositions. Right? So I don't need to care whether this is a composite of two parallel things or a tensor of two sequential things. It's unambiguous. Right. And the other point worth mentioning is I also have a type of no wire, the unit for the tensor product. And I'll represent that by not drawing anything at all. Okay, so if I have a state, let's call it psi, or let's say a morphism, let's call it psi, from this special unit object into some other space A, I would draw it as a box with no input and one output. Or I could go the other way, from some system into nothing, and again I have a wire and no output. And of course I can compose these guys and I get no inputs and no outputs. And that's perfectly legitimate as well. And if you're thinking about Hilbert spaces, then something from the ground field into a space, which is a linear map, is really just a vector, right? And so this you can think of as a ket, and this a bra, and this their inner product. Okay, so this is Dirac notation rotated 90 degrees. Did I say notation or rotation? Okay. All right. So let's go back to the idea of a dagger category. So in quantum theory, we have things which we can compose, and we have spaces which we can put in parallel. But we also have this idea of unitarity, which is very important. And so a dagger category is a category where it makes sense to talk about unitarity. And that basically means that I've got this dagger operation, which does nothing to the objects, and for every arrow, for every morphism, it gives me one in the opposite direction. Okay? And once I'm equipped with this dagger, I can write down the definition of unitary. So a morphism is unitary if its adjoint is its inverse, and self-adjoint if its adjoint is itself. Okay? And a functor, so the functor is a kind of map between categories that preserves the structure of being a category, is a dagger functor if it also preserves the dagger. Okay? And a dagger symmetric monoidal category is a monoidal category, as we just saw in the previous slides, where the tensor also respects the dagger, and the symmetry and association maps for the monoidal structure are also unitary. But again, you don't need to worry too much about this because we're not going to see much of that. Right. So examples of dagger categories. So FD Hilbert, finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, is a dagger category. The dagger is just take the usual adjoint of a map. If we are in the category of relations, so the objects will be sets and the arrows will be relations between the sets, then we can just take the opposite relation and that's the dagger. Any groupoid, so if every morphism is invertible, I can just say the inverse will be the adjoint and put a dagger on it that way. Category of spans, so a span in any category is a triple of objects and then arrows out of this middle object. Okay, and so in the category of spans, a morphism from A to B is precisely something of this shape, but I can just turn that around and make it from B to A by reversing the rules. So every span category is naturally dagger. Every cospan category is naturally dagger. And if I have a disjoint union of a category with its opposite, then there's a very obvious way to give it a dagger by just sending every map to its opposite map, which I have by construction in such a place. Okay. So the next thing we want to talk about is props. So a prop is a particularly simple kind of monoidal category. And it turns out that the collection of props admits a nice compositional theory on it, which is this is all work due to Steve Lack. So a lot of what I'm going to say in the next few slides is due to Lack. Okay. So before we talk about props, we talk about pros. So pro is, okay, let's just forget all this part. So it's a monoidal category where the objects are the natural numbers. So that just means, in our terms, where all the wires are unlabeled. They're all the same, right? So to know what type an arrow is, we just count the wires. They don't have any names. Okay? So given a pro, so one of these categories with only one object, or one generating object, I can define a T-algebra, which is just a functor taking that theory to some other place. So basically it's saying, if I think of my pro as being some kind of formal language, an algebra for it is simply a model of that language, right? Okay. And so we can form the collection of all the pros and the morphisms between them into a category which we'll call boldface pro. Okay, so if we go from pro to prop, we just ask for the category to be symmetric. So I may now cross the wires in my pictures. Okay, so let's think of a couple of examples of props. So I think of finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, but instead of taking all the Hilbert spaces, I just take the ones which are dimension the power of 2. Right, so my generating object will be the state space of a qubit, and I'm just going to have n qubits as my possible objects for every value of n. Or an even simpler example, if I take p to just be the proper permutations and nothing else. So what do I mean by this? So my objects will be natural numbers. So I have morphisms from n to n, and that collection would just be the symmetric group on n symbols. And if n and m are different, then I'll have no morphisms at all. Okay, so this is just all the permutations. Let's skip that one. Okay, so I can present props and other such things syntactically. And what I mean by that is I'll give a collection of generators and a collection of equations. And the idea is that the things in my theory are simply the things which I can make by composing these generators in sequence or in parallel. And then I quotient the whole thing by the equations. And so if I want to take two different props or two different theories and mush them together, I can just take the generators, the disjoint union of the two sets of generators, and the disjoint union of the two sets of equations. So essentially I've got two theories, and I can form elements which have parts of both, but the theories don't really interact, right? The equations don't play with each other. But it's a very simple description of such a thing. So we'll see this a bit later. All right, so the idea of a composite prop then is that I take two of them, call them T and S, and I'm going to say that whenever I've got something formed in this disjoint union, I'm allowed to commute them past each other. Okay, this is the idea of a distributive law. So you can formalize this in a more complicated way, but this is the heart of it. So I've taken my disjoint union, so I've got some T arrows and I've got S arrows, and if they are joining at the same type, they can be composed. And my distributive law says for every such pair, I can write an equation where I have an S thing followed by a T thing, instead of the other way around. Okay, and so if we have a distributive law, then effectively this means that every morphism in this composite prop can be written in this nice normal form of S things followed by T things. So this is quite a powerful tool when you're working with algebraic theories. Okay, and so in terms of syntactic presentation, if I have such a distributive law and I'm denoting it with a semicolon here, then I take the disjoint union of all the symbols, I take the equations that I started with, and I add this additional set of equations coming from the distributive law. Or equivalently, I take the disjoint union of the two theories and I quotient that by the equations. So here is a nice example. If I take any old group, I can form this thing called G times, which is just to be thought of as various copies of G in parallel. And so if I have morphisms from N systems to N systems, that'll just be N elements of the group in parallel. Okay, and if N and M are different, then I have nothing. So I can also look at that prop of permutations, thinking of that in terms of generators and equations, where I just have a single generator, the crossing, and I ask for the crossing to square to the identity, and I ask for the usual Yang-Baxter equation for permuting crossings past each other. And that will give you the theory of symmetric groups. So if I take these two things, you can see their structure is kind of similar. So I can form a new prop by putting them together with just this one equation, or rather this family of equations, saying whenever I've got something from G followed by something from P, then I can commute them. And it's just the equation you would expect, right? The G's slide down the wires and the permutation goes through. Okay, and so now we know that this composite prop is some permutation followed by a vector of elements from the group. Okay, and incidentally, since this is most of these things are groupoids and naturally dagger, so you just take the dagger to be the inverse in every case. Okay, and the second point to notice is that given any group, I can construct this prop in the way I've just described. So I've got a mapping from groups into props, and in fact it's a functor, so I can transpose any group along a homomorphism, I can get an equivalent map in the category of props. Right. So here's another example then. So commutative monoids. So here are my two generators, this 2 in, 1 out, and this 0 ins, 1 out. And the equations I'm going to ask for are simply going to say this is an associative operation. So if I think of this as a multiplication, then it could be bracketed either way. That it's a commutative operation. And that if I put the unit into the multiply, it should just be the identity. So hopefully everyone recognizes that this is just the equations for monoids. And therefore, every algebra of this prop is a monoid in whatever context you find it in. Of course, I can just take everything upside down, right? And this is now called MOP. And this is the prop of co-commutative co-monoids. And it is literally the previous slide upside down. OK. So let's do something more interesting. Prop of bi-algebras is one of these composite props. And it is the composite of the prop of monoids and the prop of co-monoids in a particular way. So I'm writing it like this way. So you see the distributive law is going to take monoids followed by co-monoids and replace and reverse the order so that the co-monoid part will always come first. Okay, and so how do I get such a law? Essentially with these equations, right? So you'll see here I have a monoid bit followed by a co-monoid bit. So I'm just going to rewrite it like this into the shape of two co-multiplications followed by two multiplications. And in all the other ones, you'll see that I have something from the monoid structure followed by something from the co-monoid structure, and I just replace it. Okay. And you can do a little bit of induction to show that that's enough. That makes everything you can write down in the composite thing these equations suffice to give you such a mapping for every object that you can write down in the composed prop. Similarly, Frobenius algebras are again monoids and comonoids, but formed in a different way. So this time we're going to commute the comonoids past the monoids. And so these two equations are sufficient to generate everything. Okay, so this is the definition of Frobenius algebras that I didn't show you earlier. Right, so again, you see I have a co-multiply followed by a multiply down here, and I reverse the order here. And this one is just the symmetric version of that. Again, co-multiply, multiply, and I just replace with the identity. Okay. Right, so I think it's probably obvious from things I said earlier that any dagger prop is a prop which has a dagger. Right? That's kind of obvious. Notice that everything we've seen so far has admitted a natural idea of dagger. So because basically this is something and its opposite. The previous one was something and its opposite. And the group example were all groupoids. So all these things have natural dagger structure. OK, that was day one. How's everyone doing? 6 days to go, huh? Right. So God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, Frobenius algebras, remember this? So I've just shown you this slide again, right? But I want to give you a particular perspective on what's going on here. So I'm saying I can always rewrite them in this form, which means that everything in this world of Frobenius algebras can be reduced to something of that shape. Which means we have the following theorem, which you might have heard of by the name of the spider theorem, says that if I have any connected diagram in this language, then I can rewrite it to something which is just determined by the number of inputs and the number of outputs. And so we can write those things as these multi-legged spiders instead of being some collection of binary operations. And a corollary of this is that the category of Frobenius algebras is self-dual and Dagger compact. And Dagger, by compact, I just mean there is an equivalent to what we call the Bell state. Right? So a bendy wire. And so we can use this to do quite a lot of things, right? This theory of Dagger Frobenius algebras is pretty rich. So if I have any old map in any algebra of this Frobenius algebra category, by which I mean in any situation where it makes sense to talk about Frobenius algebras, I can use the algebra to transpose things. So this green dot transpose is constructed by taking the two-legged spider with its legs on the top and the two-legged spider with its legs on the bottom and joining them up like this. And since this is also a dagger category, I can always reverse things with my dagger, and so it gives me a notion of conjugate as well. Okay, so obviously the conjugate will just be doing the dagger and then the transpose, or equivalently, the transpose and then the dagger. So if you cast your mind back to the concrete case, Frobenius algebras are somehow talking about bases. So it makes sense that we should be able to write down a notion of transpose with respect to a given basis. And this is what we're doing here. Okay, and we'll say that a map F is real, or green real, if it's equal to its conjugate. Okay, and in the plain old prop F, everything is real. Okay, so let's introduce a little bit more of quantum stuff here. So I mentioned earlier what the phases were. So I'm going to make a slightly different definition and say that a unitary map is called a phase with respect to a given Frobenius algebra if it obeys this equation, right? So it's on one leg and it can pass through to the other side. Notice it's only on one, not on both, right? So it's not a morphism of the monoid structure. Okay, and we'll call a point, which is to say a map from nothing into one, is called unbiased if this map, which I construct by acting on the left with the state, is a phase. Okay? And with this definition, we know that these two things are basically the same. So for every phase, there is an unbiased point that's equal to it, which you essentially get by constructing it this way. The transpose of every phase is real. The adjoint of phase is equal to the conjugate of its corresponding unbiased state with respect, again, to this left lifting map. And the multiplication that you get from the Frobenius algebra, namely this operation, the unbiased points are forming a group with respect to this multiplication, where the inverse of an element is just the conjugate. Okay? And you can see from, a little bit of calculation that if alpha is a phase, then its adjoint must also be a phase. But more interestingly, basically because the Frobenius algebra was commutative, the phases are an abelian group, the unbiased points are an abelian group, and these two groups are isomorphic. Okay. So let's see if we can add phases to the story we already started telling about Frobenius algebras. So here's this G cross prop again. So it's just the group elements, and I'm putting the equations which say that if I compose two elements in the prop, then that should be equal to their product in the underlying group. And then I would ask for these two equations here, which are just the definition of phase, as we saw a minute ago, and the same picture but backwards, right? So if we take the theory of Frobenius algebras and this group and these equations, we get not exactly a composite prop in the way I said earlier, but a three-way composite. So here we have an iterated distributive law, which is giving me, first of all, monoid things, then group things, and then co-monoid things. Okay. And so this is, again, a functor from abelian groups into the world of props. Okay. And to put the same theorem into a different form, again, whenever I have a connected diagram like this, I can always reduce it to a single spider, which is just labeled by the sum of the phases that occurred in it. Okay, so this sum here is just the addition of the abelian group. Okay, so this was the theory of one observable. Oh, this is not going to be interesting enough for us. So we will need to, we'll need to divide the waters which were under the firmament from those which are above, and let's proceed. So the theory of one observable is not that interesting, right? If we're going to do anything fun in quantum mechanics, we're going to need at least two, and we're going to ask for them to be complementary. And so what I can do, since I have for every observable I have a Frobenius algebra, I can just take two Frobenius algebras and throw them together into one theory. Okay, so this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to have a green one, and it's not just a Frobenius algebra, but it has its group of phases with it as well. And I'll have a red one, which also has its group of phases, which need not be the same. And so just by the act of forming this disjoint union, I have this kind of red, green, red, green, red, green factorization of everything I can make in this prop. So we can be more precise about this because we know already the structure of these Frobenius props. So they have this kind of bow tie shape. So I have green multiplies, green group elements, green co-multiplies, red multiplies, red group elements, red co-multiplies, and so on. Now, it doesn't take very much effort to prove that if a morphism F in this disjoint union prop is unitary, it must not have any multiplies or co-multiplies in it. So it's just a product of group elements. Okay. But we don't have any equations relating the stuff in the green group and the red group, so we're just stuck at this point. So the unitaries here are basically just going to be the free product of the unitaries that we started with in F and in G. Okay. What day have we got to so far? So, God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. And then God said, let's make these Frobenius algebras interact. Okay, so we've got this co-product, and we're going to have some interaction, by which I mean some equations which talk about the terms from one theory meeting the other theory. Right, so we've already seen very similar equations a few slides ago about bialgebras. So this is a slight modification of the usual axioms of a bialgebra. So you can see here that I have a red multiply and a green co-multiply, and I'm going to commute them. And I'm going to pick up this scalar factor here. If you want to ignore these scalar factors, you can do. It's just to make the normalization come out correctly when we interpret this in the standard setting. We have also this rule saying if I take this point here and I hit it with the co-multiplication, then I should get two copies of it. And the same in the upside down direction. So the usual theory of bialgebras has this equation as well, saying that if I form this composite of the unit and co-unit, it should just vanish. That's basically saying that this scalar is the number one. So if we interpret these things the way that I want to interpret them, that's not true. So this, in the usual models, is actually the square root of the dimension. Because you can think of this as forming the inner product between something from one basis and something from a complementary basis. Yeah? Okay, so we're not going to have this. So already you have a hint that we're not going to see a full distributive law, because I don't have any rule for commuting red stuff past green stuff in this shape. So it's not going to be quite as nice as in those other theories. So this makes it into a bialgebra, or more accurately, a scaled bialgebra, because That number is not 1. To make it into Hopf algebra, we need one extra piece of structure, namely this map S. And the equation S is supposed to satisfy is that when you form this composite, it should be equal to this thing. So if you think of group algebras, it's the antipode that sends an element to its inverse in the group, right? And this is the axiom that says that we have a group. So if something comes in, it gets copied, it gets sent to its inverse, and they get multiplied together. And that should just be the unit of the group, right? In our theory, we can define such an antipode like that. Okay, and it will obey the required equations if and only if these two weird-looking things hold. Okay, so what is it saying? It just says that this element is real when written in the red basis, and this element is real when written in the green basis. Okay. So you could also write it this way, but what I wanted to show from this picture is that it's an interaction between the monoid of one color and the monoid of the other color, which is something that we don't have in our equations so far. Okay. But as I mentioned earlier, we don't have a full distributive one. Right. So given two groups, I can form this composite theory, which I'm going to call IF for interacting Frobenius. And what I do is I just form this co-product of two different Frobenius algebras and impose the equations I showed you in the two previous slides. So notice that I've got now not just a Hopf algebra, but actually two, right? I have one with the red and green multiply and co-multiply, and one with the red and green multiply and co-multiply. Okay, so let's call one of H, call the other one H op. And so I'll just look at some of the basic properties that we get for H, but everything will apply also backwards. Okay, so this is a standard fact for any Hopf algebra. The antipode is unique. It's a bialgebra morphism, meaning that it commutes with the multiplication and the co-multiplication. It's an involution, so it squares to itself. Sorry, it squares to the identity. And it commutes with every other map that is also a homomorphism of bialgebras. So in consequence, we know the following, that it's self-adjoint and unitary, that it is real in both colors, that the same map S is the antipode for the opposite Hopf algebra, and if I transpose in red and then transpose in green, it's the same thing as transposing in green then transposing in red. And if I have no group elements, right, so I'm taking two Frobenius algebras with a trivial group of phases on both of them, then the transpose in both colors coincides with the adjoint. So this is all just consequences of that definition. Okay. And then we can also use this bialgebra structure to define a new operation on morphisms, namely the convolution product, which I'm going to write as a sum, even though I just called it a product. Okay, so if I got any two morphisms, F and F prime, I can form this thing by co-multiply first, apply F on one side, F prime on the other side, and then multiply the results back together. Right? So I call that addition. This morphism here I'll call 0, so it's just the co-unit followed by the unit. And with this sum and that element, the convolution is a commutative monoid. We can go a bit further. We can start defining the integers in the convolution. So this one is 0. I just showed that to you in the previous slide. I can make n plus 1 by taking n and convolving it with the identity. Okay, and then it's pretty straightforward to show that if you compose two of these integers, you get their product, and if you convolve them, you get their sum. And the integers, all of them, commute with the monoid and comonoid structure, meaning if I do it before the co-multiplication, it's the same thing as doing it on both sides after the co-multiplication, and vice versa. So to give you a concrete example, what do they look like? If I think of the group algebra of Z3, these are the integers. So I have this weird projector. I have the identity element, which of course should be 1. And I have this thing here, which is 2. Right. Okay. So if I think of any bi-algebra morphism, i.e. that commutes with the multiply and the co-multiply, then I have these equations. So compose distributes over plus on the left and on the right. And if I add together a map and the antipode composed of the map, I get 0. Okay, so this is saying that all the maps which commute with the structure are forming a ring, unital ring. And we also know that the same thing must hold for the opposite Hopf algebra in this category as well. But these rings are not the same, but they are related. Okay. So we can show some interesting things here. So if I've got 2 elements of this ring, such that one is the left inverse of the other, then I can show that the inverse is actually the adjoint. Okay. So that's the proof. Not that tricky. But the more interesting point is, this is telling me that the invertible elements in the ring are also in the opposite ring, right? Now, in this free construction, we don't have any invertible elements apart from 1 and the antipode, but that is not going to be true for much longer. Okay, so there you go. There's a nice little proof. What else can we say about these bi-algebra morphisms? We can say that the phases are not bi-algebra morphisms, unless they are the identity. Okay. And let me skip that one. Okay, we know that, thanks to this work of Bonjour, Slobachinsky, and Zanazzi, that the prop H for Hopf algebras is isomorphic to the collection of matrices over the ring that we're just talking about. Okay, and therefore, if we can invert the matrix in here, then the corresponding element in the prop is also unitary. Okay, good. So we've got to day 3. Yeah. So the earth has brought forth grass and herb, yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind, and God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the third day, and God said, what about set-like elements? So far what have we done? We've got these two Frobenius algebras which correspond to observables. I've asked for them to interact with various equations, which gives us a pair of Hopf algebras as well. But although I told you that the definition of one of these co-multiplies was that it sent a basis element onto 2 copies of that basis element, we haven't brought that into the theory yet. So the next thing that we're going to do is to talk about those elements, which you might think of as being the eigenstates of this observable. Okay, so this is the definition of a set-like element. Sometimes it's called group-like, sometimes it's called classical, depending whose paper you're reading. So H is set-like if, when I plug it into the co-multiplication, I get 2 copies of H. Okay? And it's standard fact that if you have a commutative Hopf algebra, the set-like elements are an abelian group, and the antipode is the thing that gives you the inverse. This is exactly as I said earlier. For our purposes, it is interesting to notice that if the green set-like elements are red unbiased, then they must form a subgroup of the phase group. Right? So all the unbiased things are in the phase group, and these are already a group, so they must be a subgroup. And since we're thinking about complementary observables, I would like to have all my set-like elements in this phase group. Okay. So is this an interesting fact? So if I have one of these set-like elements, I know that it's not unbiased for its own color. Right? That's easy to prove. And if it is, it is red unbiased if and only if it's red real. Okay. So that's a useful fact, and it motivates the following definition. So I'm going to take the prop that I had before, this IF prop. I'm going to make a new one called IFK by imposing a quotient. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to identify a subgroup of my green phases and a subgroup of my red phases, and I'm going to say that those subgroups are classical for the other color, or sorry, are set-like for the other color. Okay? So this is just a schema for all those the equations that follow from, for every H in this HK and for every G in this GK. Okay, so it turns out that many things become true now. So since we already remarked that these set-like elements are in fact unbiased points, they can be thought of as phase maps. Okay, and so if it is a phase map which corresponds to a set-like element, I call it a classical map. And so if it's classical for green, then it is a coalgebra homomorphism for green, I should say. I should say red. And you can get its adjoint by composing on both sides with the antipode. And this allows you to prove some nice things. So in particular, we can use the integers to exponentiate all these classical maps. And by raised to a power. Right, so if I have n and I feed in some classical thing k, by unpacking n into its definition, I see that I've got this tree of n co-multiplies. So k gets copied by them n times and then multiplied back together by the red structure. So I get here k followed by n is the same thing as n followed by k to the power of n. Okay. Come back to this. So before we introduced those set-like elements, the only things that we knew which were phases were things that we started with, the generators in the group. But it's not true anymore. The presence of these classical maps lets you define new things which turn out to be phases as well. Okay, so in particular, for every phase alpha from the original group, for every phase alpha, you can construct a new phase by conjugating with a classical point in this way. So if everything in this on this side of the equation is unitary, the composite of three unitary things is unitary, and you can show with a little bit of manipulation that this composite can be turned into this shape, and everything which is hanging off a green spider commutes with green spiders. So that's a phase. Don't need to show this, sorry. Okay, so now we've got an action of the group of classical points on the group of phases. Okay, and so we haven't quite worked out exactly what you get here. So it's quite like the semi-direct product of the two groups, but it's not exactly that. So I will say no more. Okay, so we've now asked for a little bit more structure but it's, say, the set of classical points. So what's the next thing that we want to do? Just to get our final step where we approach real quantum theory. Okay, I will not read this. So here's another little definition. If I've got some set of points, we say that it's enough points if I test the equality of two maps on those points is enough to determine the equality of the maps, right? So if you're thinking about linear maps being evaluated on a basis, you've got the right idea. Okay, and so any coalgebra in a vector space, the set-like elements are linearly independent. So it seems reasonable to think that set-like elements are probably enough points. So we're just going to impose that as an axiom now. So I've got my groups as before, and I'm now just going to say, okay, I'm going to pick just one of these ones, HK, and say that HK is enough points. So if two maps are equal on every point in HK, then those maps are equal. Yep.
Why Can you go back to the last slide? I'm surprised when you defined enough points, it seemed to me that that's not just a linearly independent set of vectors, but you know, a basis for the space.
Yes.
And when you're talking about, you know, you've got your two Frobenius algebras, which of course could correspond in the quantum context to two mutually unbiased bases. But if ultimately you're trying to characterize, well, okay, maybe you said something to the effect of if things are linearly independent, we're going to assume that they're enough. And that seemed to me to be
a motivational statement rather than a mathematical statement. So I'm looking for what I think might be reasonable axioms. And so since I know at a minimum that the set-like elements are linearly independent, then they might be not enough to be enough points, but I'm going to say actually, as an axiom, I'm going to demand that there are enough points.
So it seems like a poor motivation in the sense that just telling you things are linearly independent is no guarantee that they're a basis.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the precise things which you said a moment ago are linearly independent, which and which you are going to assume is enough? Can you just clarify, like you said?
Okay. So I've got my two phase groups and their two subgroups of classical points. So I'm just going to pick one of those two subgroups and say that's enough points. A priori, there's no reason why these things have to have any relation on each other, right? So in particular, HK and GK don't have to be the same cardinality or whatever. So I'm just going to pick one of them and say this one is enough points.
Okay. It's like picking one basis from your set of
yeah.
two.
Yeah.
That's complete.
I mean, it's right. So it's effectively, what's happening here is we're imposing a finite dimensionality on the space. A particular dimensionality being the cardinality of that group. Okay. So when you're actually trying to construct models of these things, it's possible to pick things which are so incompatible with each other here that you don't get a model. But if we're talking about free theories, then we don't care about this. Okay, so HK, this group of, say, red classical points, will be enough points. Okay, so the next thing that we might say is, okay, what if it's finite? So it's a theorem that you can't have special Frobenius algebras in infinite dimensions. So our spaces are always going to be finite dimensional anyway. So suppose HK is in fact finite, and the exponent of this group is d, i.e. the number of times, the maximum number of times you can add an element to itself before you get back to the identity. Then this internal ring that I mentioned before comes out to be Zd. Okay, and we can just use that equation that I showed earlier, evaluated on a classical point, to show that this is the case. So corollary of this is that when d is a prime power, then that ring is actually a field. Okay, and this is what Blanchet et al. Have in their paper. They assume from the outset that the ring is given its PID, and they construct this field of fractions out of it. So we can, if we have no phases, and this d is a prime power, then we get back their theory. However, the whole structure of IF doesn't come as a distributive law, so unlike their theory. And there are two not quite orthogonal reasons for this. So if you recall, what we need to have is whenever I've got an element from the green stuff composed an element of red stuff, I should be able to commute it the other way around. Okay, so in particular, if I take an element of the green group and I compose it with an element of the red group, I should be able to get something red followed by something green. And since I already know what structure these Frobenius things have, I know exactly the shape that that thing has. It is a group element followed by a co-multiplication, and the green one will be a multiplication followed by a group element. Okay, and so what is in the middle here is just the integer k. So if we had a distributive law, then this would hold in every model. In particular, it would hold in models where k is 0, right? So if I'm thinking my integers as being zd, then I can always pick them so that k is 0. So if k is 0, then we have this. And this thing over here is unitary, and this thing here is never unitary. So they can't agree. On the other hand, if you don't want to pick a model where k is 0, let's go back to this picture, you can just think of a concrete example. So a concrete example of one of these theories is the one where we take qubits with z rotations and x rotations as the two groups. And if we had such a distributive law, it would say that whenever we've got a z rotation, we can commute it past an x rotation. And this is false, right? So there's no distributive law for this theory, which is slightly disappointing, but at least means that quantum theory and Petri nets are not the same thing. OK, so we have created the great whales, every living creature that moveth, which in waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And it was the evening of the morning of the fifth day. And then God said, this is not yet quantum theory. This has not been completed and still ongoing work. But I think I've probably bored you long enough, so I will stop there. Thanks.
Go back to the beginning of the talk and sort of repeat the kind of motivation of like what kind of an understanding of quantum theory you want. I think it would be useful to see that over again in the context of everything else that came out, because now I'm feeling a little bit unclear about where quantum theory is going to come out of this. So maybe not the very beginning, but yeah, around here, they go back a couple. This business here. Mm-hmm. So you seem to say early on that this fact that you could decompose a pair of Frobenius algebras as also as a pair of Popper algebras was, you thought, something about quantum theory, and then this other paper came out that said it was something about
Petri
nets. So this whole talk was working up to try to redirect something like that, am I right? Or?
So it would, yes, partly that. So what I would have liked to have seen, and which you might still get in some more complicated form than what we've tried to do so far, is to show that this theory of two complementary observables is a composite prop in the sense of having a distributive law. Okay, so this theory of Petri nets of Bonchi et al. Does arise as a distributive law because they put in enough stuff. They put in the right stuff. So they don't have the phase groups around, which are a big obstacle for this version, for the quantum version of the theory. And they also have the fact that their underlying objects are essentially trivial, right? They're one-dimensional. Whereas here we have arbitrary dimensions. And the fact that that dimension may have zero divisors is another obstacle to having this distributive law. So what we were hoping to do is to somehow give a purely algebraic presentation of what's happening in finite dimensional quantum theory, or rather the fragment of it you can express in two observables.
Two strongly coupled.
Yeah. I mean, it's worth remarking that if you pick your groups correctly. So, where was I? Is it taking too long? So, right here. So, my theory of my observable is the algebra, or the Frobenius algebra, along with the group of let's say, the dynamics which don't change the observable, right? So the set-like elements or the eigenstates of this observable are fixed by the phase group. So if you pick the phase group to be rotations this way and this way. Sorry, the z rotations for the z observable, the x rotations for the x observable, then the theory that you get out of here is sufficient to cover all of qubit quantum mechanics. But not every true equation is derivable in the theory. So it's certainly rich enough to express anything you might want to say, but maybe not. But it's not powerful enough to prove every theorem you might want to prove. But so I'll show you one thing that you can do with this, which is somewhat to do with my motivations for pursuing it. I can go back full screen here. So with that interpretation I was talking about, we can translate quantum circuits, right? So here's a quantum circuit, random one. I can put it into this red green language like so. And so these are red ones are x rotations, green ones are z rotations. Okay, and now because I know a lot about the structure of this theory, I have in particular for every one of those sub-theories the normal form that comes from the distributive law. So if I look at a circuit like this, I can kind of think of the vertical lines as being a qubit persisting through time. But I can also draw things, this is actually the same diagram, just deformed slightly. I can draw things which are kind of unphysical looking, but mathematically equivalent. And then I can use the fact that this sub-diagram is an element of just one of those theories. In particular, it's an element in theory of Hopf algebras. And so that has normal form, so we can change it around. So that's, again, just another tensor network of the same thing. And I can now view this as an MBQC. So the vertices now we think of as qubits, which have either been measured or not measured, depending whether or not there's a wire coming out of them. Okay, I'll skip this part. But you can kind of see this picture as encoding something about a reasonable architecture for a quantum computer, right? So you can think of these parts as being small ion traps with this interconnection. So this is kind of what the people in the NKIT project in the UK are trying to build. And so the fact that you can reduce any old quantum circuit, oops, which we maybe have no idea how to implement on their computer, into something which seems feasible is kind of a bonus that one gets from having these normal forms around. Yeah.
So one thing that wasn't clear is you said you have a normal form because of the distributive law.
Mm-hmm.
But you also said that the distributive law didn't hold in general. So
right. So but if you trace the way that theory was built up, it was built up as being a composite of something very simple and distributive law, and then a composite of two things, of those which have been a distributive law and so on. So it's really only at the final step that we don't have a distributive law of the whole thing, but all those little sub-theories have a distributive law. So you saw, what was the thing that I did right here? The transformation I've done is to take those rotations out of the picture or out to the edges, because those guys don't have a distributive law. But I can still pull them out because each color is this Frobenius structure, so that has its own distributive law, so I can do this. And now that I don't look at the phases, that's a plain Hopf algebra without phases, so that does have a distributive law. So you can kind of think of one of these pictures as being sort of decomposable into zones, depending on which elements of the theory occur in it, and that each zone will have a normal form.
So for qubits, they're not two but three mutually unbiased mm-hmm. spaces. So this is a naive question, but is there such a thing as like three interacting Frobenius algebra? I mean, there are two colors, so could you have three colors?
So some people have tried to do it, and it doesn't give you such a nice theory. And the reason is not that difficult to understand. You think about, I don't want to page back through all the slides. If you think about the equations of a Hopf algebra, what it's saying is that you've got these two phase groups, and one point in that phase group is the unit of a given So I have three unbiased variables. Two of them must be unbiased to the third one, right? In particular, both of those groups have to have a unit, and the phase group doesn't have two units. So you start talking about cosets of one with respect to the other, and it gets a bit kludgy. So no one's really worked out what to do in the more general case. Yeah. So if you've got the classical points around as well, then that gives you some symmetries inside the phase group to help you pick out the other ones. What I said there was not quite right, but I can say something more accurate if you want. So the interesting thing is where the two phase groups intersect, right? So if you have non-zero intersection, then it gives you the third mutually unbiased basis. So a priori, in this purely axiomatic framework, there's no reason for those groups to have an intersection. Of course, in the models, they usually do.
If there are no more questions, we can thank Charles again.